This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And the juntas aren't protecting citizens or building the support with local communities that allows these insurgencies to gain and maintain momentum. And so that's why we've seen a near tripling in the number of fatalities linked to these militant Islamist groups in the Sahel.
That was Joseph Siegel, director of research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies on how the strategy of fighting insurgencies in military-run Sahel countries contributes to the problem. Details coming up. Also, an unknown illness has killed more than 50 people in northwestern Democratic Republic of Congo, and Human Rights Watch is accusing a Sudanese army-aligned force of an attack on a village that left at least 26 people dead. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. A new study by the Africa Center for Strategic Studies shows that fatalities and violent events linked to militant Islamist groups in Africa occurred at a near record pace, with the Sahel and Somalia accounting for 79% of related deaths. There were an estimated 18,900 fatalities linked to militant Islamist violence in Africa in 2024. The Sahel remained the most lethal region on the continent for the fourth year in a row. Joseph Siegel, director of research at the center and author of the study, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the reasons behind this rise.
Well, there are many reasons. Successful counterinsurgencies are complex, and they require sustaining progress across a multiple level of front and require a whole-of-government approach. You know, ultimately, successful counterinsurgencies are about gaining the support of the population in defeating the insurgents. That requires a military component, a sustaining pressure on the militant. It requires having disciplined and agile security forces. You know, it requires respecting human rights so that you're not alienating these populations. But it also requires some important governance elements. It requires legitimate government that people would trust. It requires controlling corruption. It requires investing in services so that people see a better future working with that government. It requires a longer-term effort to build trust and support with local communities to turn them away from the insurgencies. And these are things that we're not seeing the military juntas in the Sahel doing. Instead, you know, they've been taking heavy-handed tactics, using indiscriminate force against civilians in the contested areas. And this is driving recruitment to the militant groups. The juntas have pushed away the UN peacekeeping force in Mali, MINUSMA. They pushed away the regional partners from ECOWAS, the European countries that had been providing forces and support. And so they don't have the troop strength and coverage that they need to do all the things that are necessary to combat these insurgencies. And the juntas aren't protecting citizens or building the support with local communities that allows these insurgencies to gain and maintain momentum. And so that's why we've seen a near tripling in the number of fatalities linked to these militant Islamist groups in the Sahel since the first coup in Mali in 2020. And instead, we're seeing, you know, continued advances by the militant groups moving further south in each of the three countries, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, and pushing towards borders with the coastal West Africa countries.
The study indicated that of all incidents of armed violence against civilians in the Sahel, there were more fatalities that is linked to the Sahelian security forces and the Russian allies than there were civilian fatalities linked to the militant Islamist groups in 2024. What's your take on that?
It is very revealing. This past year, we saw that there are about 2,100 deaths linked to the Sahelian forces and the Russian allies, compared to about 1,750 fatalities linked to the militant Islamist groups. These are fatalities of civilians. We don't see that in any other militant Islamist theaters in Africa, Lake Chad Basin, Somalia, or Mozambique. And so it underscores the heavy-handed approach that the Sahelian juntas are taking in combating the militant Islamists. They're are showing a high level of impunity and disregard for human rights. They're using collective punishment against communities that are suspected of supporting the jihadist. And this has fallen particularly heavily on the Fulani ethnic groups. This is even though most Fulani do not support the jihadist, but they're in a position, since they're being attacked, of aligning themselves with the insurgencies. And so this is further complicating and fueling the militant Islamist violence that we're seeing in the Sahel.
Militant Islamist violence, fatalities in northern Mozambique rose by 36% in 2024, continuing its rolling trajectory of recent years, as the study indicated. Why was that happening in this specific African nation?
This is a very high percentage of violence against civilians, and it reflects the tactics of the militant Islamist group operating there. It's known by many names, but most commonly it's Ahlus-Sunnah wal Jama'ah, ASWJ. And ASWJ uses fear and intimidation against local populations to get their support or at least acquiescence. This group is not trying to govern or reform or offer an alternative. It's really just lashing out against the government and intimidating communities to try and garner more capacity for itself. It's not organized or operating in a cohesive manner as we see in some of the other theaters like Somalia or Sahel or Lake Chad Basin. It's much more loosely organized, with the militant groups acting in smaller units that are not accountable. They're living off the land, they're pillaging, and the civilians are paying the cost for this as ASWJ moves away from its base on the coast and moves inland to smaller communities.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies here in Washington, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy. The World Health Organization and doctors on the ground say an unknown illness has killed more than 50 people in northwestern Democratic Republic of Congo. A hospital medical director in the affected region told the Associated Press that the interval between the onset of symptoms and death has been 48 hours in most cases, and that's what's really worrying. The outbreak began on January 21st, and 419 cases have been recorded, including 53 deaths. The WHO says samples from 13 cases all tested negative for Ebola or similar diseases. Botswana authorities say at least 9 people were confirmed dead Monday as rare flooding hit the semi-arid country. More than 5,000 people have been affected by the floods as record rainfall fell over the last week. From Habrone, Mokondisi Dube reports.
Of the deceased, 6 were minors, while at least 815 children have been evacuated to safer areas. Addressing Parliament Monday, Moedi Mwasa, the Minister for State President, said the 9 lost their lives through drowning.
The health risk level has generally reduced. We regret to inform this House that we have lost one more person yesterday evening. Within tonight, the total number of fatalities. So far, the number of people evacuated has increased from 1,806 from 1,749 reported yesterday.
The United Nations Children Fund, UNICEF, says at least 600,000 school children were experiencing disruptions due to the floods. Mwasa says schools which were closed last week will reopen Tuesday, except in some areas still experiencing flooding.
After a thorough assessment of the situation, we are happy to announce that schools will reopen tomorrow, February 25th, 2025. Another positive note is that our critical infrastructure remains stable, with both electricity and water supply restored. Our 24-hour clinics, primary hospitals, and referral hospitals are operational and accessible to all, although there may be occasional interruptions in service provision.
While the situation is improving with rain subsiding, more than 600 people remained at evacuation centers Monday. Calvin Mwalusi, a Habron resident who was at one of the centers, says he lost his belongings due to the floods.
I've never seen so much water in my life. The house became a pool of water, and it's really sad that some people escaped away in the floods. The government has done its best to evacuate people and take them to safe areas.
Most parts of the country recorded heavy rains of between 150 millimeters to 200 millimeters in a 24-hour period several times last week. Kutlwano Mokokomane, chief executive at the local Red Cross Society, says the organization is continuing to provide relief at evacuation centers across the country.
The Botswana Red Cross Society had provided relief items to the evacuation centers. We continue to provide these relief items to ensure that our communities are kept safe. We provided food items, mattresses and blankets, and also hygiene packs. We also are currently doing assessments so that they can further guide our response.
Botswana, like most Southern African countries, has been recovering from the devastating El Nino-induced drought. Mkondisi Dube, VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
President Donald Trump says he's nearing a deal with Ukraine and Russia to end the war in Ukraine after a packed day of meetings at the White House with France's leader Emmanuel Macron. The U.S. president urged Europe to take a bigger role at the meeting, and France pushed for more assurances from Moscow. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the White House.
A quick bienvenue, then straight down to business for France's president at this high-stakes White House meeting on bringing the war in Ukraine to an end. President Donald Trump pushed his desire for a deal to end the war, which on Monday struck its grim third anniversary. He has said this will include an agreement with Ukraine for its critical minerals, a deal he hinted could be signed as soon as next week by Ukraine's president.
There's tremendous distrust on both sides. That's why it's good that I'm coming in now, but I think it's to the very much benefit of Russia to make a deal and to go on with leading Russia in a very positive way. That's what you have to do. But I really believe that he wants to make a deal. Maybe wrong, but I believe he wants to make a deal.
French President Emmanuel Macron was more circumspect, correcting Trump in the Oval Office when he said Europe supported Ukraine with a loan, and then giving this warning about trusting Moscow.
My strong point was to say, let's try to get something first which can be assessed, checked and verified. And let's be sure that we build sufficient guarantees on the short run. And this is where we are ready to be engaged. As for France, a lot of my European colleagues are ready to be engaged. But we do need this American backup, because this is part of the credibility of the security guarantees. And this is our collective deterrence capacity. And I have the feeling that the president has this capacity.
Analysts spoke of what the two leaders actually accomplished in their meetings. William Pomerantz is a senior fellow at the Wilson Center.
It looks like they agreed to have European peacekeepers enforce the peace between Russia and Ukraine. There are a lot of other side issues that I haven't really been able to get a hold of. But yes, there's an attempt to have a peace agreement and a use of peacekeepers to enforce the agreement between Russia and Ukraine.
Ukraine's president expressed Canada's hope and emphasized the importance of Washington's role.
Our teams are already working productively with the U.S. on economic agreement, which we hope to sign in Washington. And President Trump, we would really like to hear from you, because all our people, all our families are very worried. Will there be support from America? Will America be the leader of the free world? And I want to be very honest with you. For our people, for life in general, it's so important that American support, American assistance remains.
But other world leaders expressed concerns that Ukraine was kept out of high-level discussions in Saudi Arabia between Washington and Moscow. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan.
Apart from the Istanbul process, Russia has been excluded from the tables established so far, and therefore the desired result has not been achieved. If results are to be obtained from the new process, Ukraine must definitely be included in the process, and this war must be ended through mutual negotiations.
Russia's leader said that so far, talks have not been specific. Russian President Vladimir Putin.
During the phone conversation and the meeting in Riyadh, We certainly touched on issues related to the Ukrainian crisis. However, it was not discussed in essence. We only agreed that we would approach it. That being said, of course, we are not rejecting the participation of European countries.
Meanwhile, in Europe, Ukraine somberly marked Monday as the third anniversary of this brutal war. Paris's most famous icon, the Eiffel Tower, burned bright with the colors of the Ukrainian flag. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
Human Rights Watch is accusing a Sudanese army-aligned force of an attack on a village that left at least 26 people dead, property looted, and homes burned. The French news service, AFP, cited the Rights Monitor as saying the Sudan Shield forces intentionally targeted civilians in a January 10th attack on Tayaba, an Al-Jazeera state. The village is the site of fighting between the army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, which has intensified in recent weeks. In related news, the Associated Press reports that Doctors Without Borders has suspended all its work at the Zamzam camp in Sudan, where around 500,000 people live, seeking safety from the nation's civil war. The medical aid group said fighting between the military and the RSF has made it impossible for the group to provide life-saving humanitarian help. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. We'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. Kenya has deployed heavy security at its border with Ethiopia after an attack by armed men in what authorities describe as cross-border clashes. The Associated Press reports 20 people are missing. Interior Minister Kipchumba Murkomen says the government is working with authorities in Ethiopia to find them. Authorities say fishermen from Ethiopia clashed with Kenyan counterparts at the Omo River on Saturday, and 15 boats are missing. The Tukana community from Kenya and the Dashenech community from Ethiopia share economic activities such as pastoralism and fishing. U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth recently provided reasons for the ouster of Joint Chief of Staff Chairman General C.Q. Brown. President Donald Trump fired the top U.S. military officer Friday via a social media post. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bapp has the details.
U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has brushed aside concerns that President Donald Trump's firing of the top U.S. military officer, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General C.Q. Brown, could be seen as injecting politics into the military. Hegseth spoke to the cable news show Fox News Sunday.
This is a reflection of the president wanting the right people around him to execute the national security approach we want to take. And I have a lot of respect for C.Q. Brown. I got to know him over the course of a month. He's an honorable man, not the right man for the moment.
Trump vowed on the campaign trail to wipe out what he called woke ideologies from the military and swiftly dismiss many top leaders, a goal shared by Hegseth in a podcast prior to his nomination for Secretary of Defense.
Well, first of all, you got to fire, you got to fire the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
In 2022, when Brown was the chief of staff of the Air Force, he and his civilian counterpart under the Biden administration issued a memo calling for Air Force officer recruitment goals based on race and sex in an effort to achieve a force the memo said would be, quote, more representative of the United States. Luis Caldera served as Secretary of the Army during the Obama administration.
Punishing senior military leaders because they were appointed in the previous administration or carried out the policies of the previous administration, just as they would expect them to carry out the policies of this administration, is just wrong.
In addition to Brown's firing, Hegseth removed Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Lisa Franchetti, Air Force Vice Chief of Staff General Jem Slife, and the Judge Advocates General, or JAGS, for the Army, Navy, and Air Force.
It's not lost on anyone that they have removed the only African-American and the only woman who served on the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Hegseth has made lethality the top priority of the force, saying the military's strength is not in its diversity, but in its unity.
Our strength is our shared purpose, regardless of our background, regardless of how we grew up, regardless of our gender, regardless of our race.
Hegseth travels Tuesday to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to get a firsthand look at the U.S. military facilities holding undocumented migrants. The Department of Homeland Security is holding 17 immigration detainees in military facilities there. The Trump administration has detained dozens of other migrants at Guantanamo before deporting them. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
The Vatican issued a statement Monday saying Pope Francis remains in critical condition but has shown a slight improvement. The 88-year-old Pope was admitted to Rome's Gamelli Hospital on February 14th with a serious respiratory illness that has triggered other health problems. Many Catholics and tourists at St. Peter's Square on Tuesday expressed worry and hope over the pontiff's condition. The Vatican has described the Pope's infection as complex and said it was caused by two or more microorganisms. Double pneumonia is a serious infection that can inflame and scar both lungs, making it difficult to breathe. Francis, who has been Pope since 2013, has suffered bouts of ill health over the past 2 years. He is particularly prone to lung infections after an illness as a young adult cost him part of one lung. Federal funding freezes to a variety of programs are affecting U.S. farmers across the country. VOA's Ken Farbo has more with dairy farmers from the Midwestern U.S. state of Wisconsin.
Farmer Andy Hatch grows and produces what the state of Wisconsin is famous for.
Cows and cheese. It's really what, you know, built our state and still is a hugely important part of our economy. $46 billion impact on our state.
A key source of Hatch's income is a specialty cheese that ages on racks in his facility.
It will age for about a year before we sell it. It's in here biding its time, becoming delicious.
To compete with European cheese producers that are heavily subsidized by their governments, Hatch needs to upgrade and expand.
To be competitive, we need support from public institutions, from the government.
Hatch turned to the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS, for funding.
We applied for and were awarded federal funding through the NRCS. And that funding was meant to cover about 25% of a project that will stretch over $1 million.
Hatch had already spent about $50,000 on designs for modern, environmentally friendly facilities for housing and feeding cows that produce milk for cheese. When he received notice in January that funding for USDA conservation projects was frozen.
We've not started construction, and we won't until we're sure that the funding we were promised is going to come through.
We're not getting paid or reimbursed for work that we have done.
Joe Tamondel is executive director of the Dairy Grazing Alliance, which also depends on USDA funding for a variety of projects, including apprenticeship programs intended to train a new generation of dairy farmers and agricultural workers.
We understand, you know, the objectives of the administration and coming in and making sure that there isn't any abuse of the systems. We just hope that we're not an unintended consequence of it, because, you know, we really align with what this administration is looking at doing.
Uncertainty is the biggest risk for all actors in the agricultural supply chain.
Andrew Stevens is an assistant professor of agriculture and applied econometrics at the University of Wisconsin. He says even if funds begin to flow again, farmers will be wary about future reimbursements.
The uncertainty of these federal freezes is really going to shift how farmers are making decisions and calls into question things that used to be taken for granted.
In her first comments to reporters after being confirmed as the Trump administration's U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Brooke Rollins said one of her top priorities was addressing federal funding freezes.
If there are farmers that are indeed waiting for payments that have been committed to them, those will come through.
We will pause. We will wait.
Farmer Andy Hatch hopes the federal funding he was promised arrives soon.
But if it doesn't, we won't be able to build.
Despite the funding delays, the USDA projects overall net U.S. farm income in 2025 will increase about 30% over 2024. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Dodgeville, Wisconsin.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.